From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a personal history of Israel. We talk with Abba Iban, who argued for Israel's statehood before the United Nations, then became Israel's first ambassador to the UN. He's also the former ambassador to the United States and former deputy prime minister of his country. Also today, the New World Disorder. We talk with professor and journalist Fred Halliday about what the world's trouble spots have in common. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Bill Clinton spoke by satellite to a group of Caribbean Basin trade officials meeting in Miami today. He also continued his cabinet search, as NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Little Rock.
Clinton aides said the president-elect's first appointments could come next Wednesday, after he returns from a trip to Washington to meet with members of Congress and transition officials. The first appointments will be the cabinet positions dealing with the economy. Clinton has said the latest positive economic numbers may also cause him to reevaluate some aspects of his short-term economic plans, the ones designed to give the economy a quick boost. Clinton has said he would be flexible. Today, George Stephanopoulos, Clinton's communications director, was asked whether that flexibility would extend to the middle-class tax cut Clinton campaigned on. Stephanopoulos said some form of the tax cut would have to stay in Clinton's package. Although the tax cut has been criticized by economists as being unnecessary, it may end up being a political promise Clinton finds it necessary to keep. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
Yugoslavia's prime minister has apparently been thwarted in his bid to run against the hardline nationalist president of Serbia. Milan Panic, a naturalized American, has been serving as Yugoslavia's prime minister since July. His efforts to end the Yugoslav civil war have been opposed by Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. Panic said recently that he'd run against Milosevic in the national elections on December 20th. The head of Yugoslavia's election commission said today that Panic failed to meet the one-year residency requirement to run for president. United Nations officials are attempting to negotiate the release of six UN peacekeepers abducted by Khmer Rouge guerrillas yesterday, but a UN spokesman said Khmer Rouge officials have so far been uncooperative in the talks. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The six officers were taken by Khmer Rouge forces on Tuesday while observing troop movements in central Cambodia. UN officials say the rebel group has accused the officers of spying. Those taken consisted of three Britons, two Filipinos, and a New Zealander. Then today, a French officer trying to investigate the abduction was wounded after his helicopter was sprayed with automatic weapons fire. The abductions took place just one day after the Security Council voted to impose mild trade sanctions on the Khmer Rouge for violating the Paris Peace Accords. UN officials say the rebel group has refused to disarm and demobilize its troops. The abductions are the most direct challenge to UN authority in Cambodia so far. A UN spokesman in New York called the abductions a very serious development that is putting enormous pressure on the UN peacekeeping operation. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 3,286. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. The CIA is reportedly trying to buy back Stinger missiles that it provided to Muslim rebels in Afghanistan. The Associated Press quoted U.S. officials who said the intelligence agency is worried that the shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles could fall into the hands of Iran. One source reportedly told the AP that the CIA provided the Afghan rebels with hundreds of the Stinger missiles between 1986 and 1990. Officials are now concerned that the weapons could fall into the hands of terrorists or governments unfriendly to the United States. El Salvador's left-wing rebels started to destroy their weapons today under the supervision of United Nations military observers. Tom Gibb reported visited a rebel camp to see the destruction.
Top rebel commanders and UN observers watched as two guerrilla fighters burned their way through an AK-47 assault rifle with a blowtorch. This is just the start of the destruction of the rebels' arsenal, which includes rocket launchers, mortars, and anti-aircraft missiles, as well as machine guns. The rebels are emphatic that this is not a surrender. In return, the government is having to carry out widespread reforms, which are meeting with considerable opposition from the right wing and from the army. The most controversial is a purge of dozens of senior army officers accused of abuses to be implemented by the end of the month. Elite battalions are also due to be disbanded. The rebels warn that if the government doesn't carry out its side of the bargain, the destruction of weapons will also stop. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
A British government audit has found that Britain made a profit of almost $1 billion from its involvement in the Gulf War. The National Audit Office reported today that contributions from foreign governments, including Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, exceeded what the Ministry of Defense spent on the war. The audit found that Britain's involvement against Iraq cost about $2.25 billion. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the founding fathers of Israel, Abba Iban. After World War II, he negotiated for an independent Jewish state with Great Britain, which had been administering Palestine under a League of Nations mandate since 1923. In 1947, Iban made the case for a Jewish state to the United Nations. When Israel achieved statehood, Iban became his country's first ambassador to the UN. During most of the 10 years he held that position, he also served as Israel's ambassador to the United States. He's held many other prominent positions in Israel, including Deputy Prime Minister, Minister of Foreign Affairs, and Member of the Knesset. Iban was born in South Africa, grew up in England, served in Palestine during World War II, and remained there after the war. Iban recently described himself as one of the last central witnesses to the drama of Israel's birth. He's committed to documenting that history. His new book is a memoir called Personal Witness, Israel Through My Eyes. He also hosts a new public TV series called Israel, A Nation is Born. This is an excerpt of a speech that Abba Iban made to the United Nations in 1956.
We know that Israel is most popular when it does not hit back, and world opinion is profoundly important to us. So on one occasion after another, we have buried our dead, tended our wounded, clenched our teeth in suppressed resentment and hope that this very moderation will deter a repetition of the offense. But sometimes the right and duty of self-preservation prevails in the final and reluctant decision.
Do you remember the occasion of that address?
Yes, it was on the 1st of November at midnight, 1956. And the address was in the context of a war that was then going on between Israel and the Egyptians. For once, we were supported by two major powers, by Britain and France. But what I said in those few remarks really summarized the entire Israeli condition. Here we were, having been a state for 8 years, and yet constantly attacked, having the waterways blocked against us, having our water threatened, and having daily incursions into our country for people coming to plunder and to kill. And this was a sort of a cry of the heart against the continuation of that situation, and a hope that the international community would try to give us that kind of security that it does give to every other state in the international community.
You said in that speech, Israel is most popular when it does not hit back. Do you think Israel has had to defend its right to use force in ways
that
never would be expected of other countries?
More recently, I think we've had more understanding for our need to respond when we are attacked, especially since in 1967, there was a feeling across the world that we had carried patience perhaps a little too far. Here were the Egyptians with 100,000 troops and 1,000 tanks in Sinai. Here were the Syrians poised for an attack in the north. Here were wild crowds in all the Arab countries calling for our blood. Here were Iraqi and Moroccan troops converging upon us. And the world watched with the breathless indignation, but also suspense, to see if and when we would be able to respond. I think that since those days, it's been fully understood that one way of encouraging aggression is simply to submit to it. And therefore, the feeling that we should never hit back and should simply turn our other cheek, I think that has been less marked in recent years than before.
How possible do you think a true and lasting peace
is between Israel and its Arab neighbors and the Palestinians?
Well, first of all, it's a reality. It's a reality in relation to the Arab and Muslim state, which took the lead in all the wars against Israel. One must understand that a peace treaty with Egypt completely refutes the idea of the irreconcilability of conflicts. There is no such thing as an irreconcilable conflict. And therefore, peace is something of which you should never despair. Peace happens when there is a convergence of self-interest on behalf of a peaceful solution. And therefore, it's an intelligent thing to do, to keep working at it, not to despair of it, especially when the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty has worked so well.
The peace talks are stalled now, and the Palestinians in the occupied territories just voted against accepting Israel's offer of partial autonomy because they thought it didn't go far enough. Do you think that these talks will continue and lead to anything, or are you concerned about their future?
Of course, they're going to lead to agreements, undoubtedly. The fact that at the moment our positions are not identical, that's almost an inane thing to say because the media, which are professionally devoted to pessimism, keep asking us every week or month, well, you haven't reached an agreement yet. Well, let's not forget that Anwar Sadat came to Jerusalem in November 1977. A peace treaty was signed in March 1979, and the last Israeli forces left Sinai sometime in 1982. Therefore, don't ask for a quick fix, because there is a long background and record of distrust and a total lack of mutual confidence. But the fact that we're talking together with civility and in a context of examining issues, substantive issues, think of what's happened in the past year. It's not a wasted year. During that year, Syria has passed from virulent non-recognition and hatred to what they call a policy of wanting total peace. During that year, the Palestinians have been studying the kind of projects and proposals which they vehemently rejected only a year and a half ago. Here they're discussing these. Here we have Jordan coming up every week with a proposal for a peace treaty with Israel. And here there's now an Israeli government, which has changed tangentially in the past year from asking for 100% of territory and 100% of sovereignty and 100% of everything to what I call the lucid and visionary ideas of our founding fathers, namely that since there are two nations within the Palestinian area, therefore you cannot have one state completely dominating all the others, that something has to be shared. Territory has to be shared and sovereignty has to be shared. All of that within a single year as a result of the Gulf War and of the collapse of communism. And if there are now periods of halting, which there are, it's your fault. It's the fault of the United States, because it's impossible to imagine that we're going to reach binding agreements without a third party. Our experience tells us that whenever you have an Arab and an Israeli delegation, each of those two can accept from a trusted third party something which neither of them can initiate itself and neither of them can expect from its adversary. Initiate themselves because of domestic constituencies and can't accept from the rival party for fear of looking weak. And therefore, the American role is vital, and of course it's suspended because of what I might call your almost infinitely long electoral processes.
You grew up in a Zionist house. Your mother was a Zionist, and in fact she translated the Balfour Doctrine into French and Russian in 1979, and that was the doctrine that promised a Jewish home in Palestine. What did Zionism mean to you as a boy?
Well, first of all, there was this family experience, something exalted that had lit up our sky, and the glow of it would never be lost, because there in the middle of the First World War, we had this extraordinary visionary leadership of Chaim Weizmann, who thought that he could get the British government, then the strongest in the world, to adopt the Zionist program for the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. Now, that was a typically Zionist idea, 90% fantasy and 10% realism. And yet here within a few years, this breakthrough had occurred. Jews were not suffering as they were later to suffer under Nazism, but they were suffering pretty sharply in the Russian Empire. and they remembered the inquisitions. The Jews were not equal in their status for very many years in Europe. And therefore, although I was perfectly peaceful and tranquil as a Cambridge Don and had no personal need to join this very embattled and rather precarious cause, I felt when the Holocaust took place during the Second World War, I felt that I ought to put my allegiance and my person in the same place. And I was so captivated by the Zionist idea that I thought I should give it my full loyalty. I therefore gave up my prospects of continuing my academic career at Cambridge or joining the British Foreign Office or even running for Parliament. All these abilities, possibilities were in my hands, and I went right over to the very embattled and precarious Zionist cause.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Abba Eban, and he was Israel's first ambassador to the United Nations. He's served in the cabinet of several prime ministers. He's been a longtime member of the Knesset. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Abba Eban, one of the founding fathers of Israel. He's the author of a new memoir called Personal Witness, Israel Through My Eyes. And he's also the host of a new public TV series called A Nation Is Born, Personal Witness. After Israel became a nation, Israel was attacked just as the celebrations were continuing. What were your feelings right after independence with these mixed emotions of feeling very, very elated and victorious at statehood, but knowing that you were going to be under attack?
We didn't have any time for celebration because our state was established by a declaration of independence on the 14th of May, and of course that was received with delirious joy. At the same time, the United States, by order of President Truman, recognized our statehood within 11 minutes of our proclaiming it, and the Soviet Union also joined in that recognition. So that was on the positive side. The bad news was that the Arab countries, which had not entered the state, Israel, in their capacity as armies of states, all converged upon us. We were no longer being attacked by guerrillas, by private armies, but by the armies of five Arab states, full of armaments, outweighing our own very poor armaments. And therefore, I would say that we felt the joy of birth and the fear of death in the same moment.
What has been one of the most difficult decisions you have had to make on issues of war and peace in Israel?
In 1967, we had to take a vote because here were the Arab states converging upon us, getting nearer and nearer to our population centers, intoxicated by the apathy of the international community. As you know, the United Nations very unwisely withdrew its peace forces just when we needed those peace forces most to prevent belligerency and to save the peace, and we were in very great danger. We had to decide when and if to vote for war. And I advocated restraint because I said, first of all, we must avoid a situation in which we win the war and are then thrown back as we were in 1956 by a joint action of the United States and the Soviet Union. So I said, well, let me go to Washington and to Paris and to London and see if we can get support so that even if they don't help us in the field, which we never asked for, they wouldn't just throw us back. And therefore, I had to call for over nearly 3 weeks of delay. And then one day on the 5th of June, everybody had to vote. Our Prime Minister, Mr. Eshkol, said he wants everybody to vote for or against. You can't just dodge this issue. And I saw my hand going up with all the other hands. Yes, we were just going to war.
Why was it such a difficult decision for you to make to vote to go to war?
Because according to all the statistics, we had no certainty of winning. The fact that in 6 days we had this spectacular victory was always regarded as almost impossible. We thought that we would people our hospitals were prepared for tens of thousands of casualties. Graves were being dug. That was the atmosphere in which we then voted.
After the Six-Day War, you tried to begin peace talks with the Arabs. What did you try to do?
We thought, perhaps unrealistically at the time, that because they were so battered and defeated and demoralized, that that would be a good time for them to think of peace. Well, that turned out not to be true. Perhaps we shouldn't have believed that. It was the fact that they were defeated and demoralized that made it more difficult for them to come to the table, because they had lost their pride. And they had no reason to regard the military situation created by the Six-Day War as a realistic reflection of their strength. It didn't reflect their strength. And within a few months, they had replenished their arms. After all, no Arab government fell and no Arab capital was captured. And therefore, it was perhaps wrong on our side to believe that they would start peace negotiations on the basis of the extremely inferior balance of power which existed then. They had to restore their pride. Well, they did this, I'm afraid, at the expense of many Israeli losses. In 1973, on the positive side, the fact that their pride was not humiliated made them more congenial for peace, and we did have a peace conference at Geneva in the end of 1973.
If the time wasn't right after the Six-Day War, what do you think makes the time right now for peace talks?
Well, it's right now because I would say that there's more humility in Israel and less depressive lack of confidence in the Arab states. Moreover, there's the attritional effect of time. If the Arabs had a chance of getting their territory back without peace, surely they'd have achieved that by now. After all, it's 15 years since the Six-Day War. And if Israel had a chance of getting peace while keeping all the territories, well, why hasn't that happened yet? And as I once said, and I noticed the Oxford Book of Quotations has quoted me as once saying that men and nations behave wisely once they have exhausted all the other alternatives. I really think that the Arabs and Israel have exhausted all the other alternatives except making peace with each other.
Now, you really never believed that Jews and Arabs could coexist in the same state without one submitting to the other. Why did you never believe that?
Well, because it's obviously true. Let us examine that a unitary state had been established in Palestine in 1948. The Arabs would have been, what was it? They would have been over 1 million, and we would have been 600,000. So we would have been a minority, and we have a pretty clear knowledge they wouldn't have treated us with any tolerance. Now, supposing it was the other way around and that now Israel were to take over the whole of the government in a single state, we would have 1,800,000 Palestinian Arabs, members of a different nation, who do not share our flag or our faith or our tongue or our national experience, and they would have a very bad time of it. They would be humiliated. Therefore, the best thing is to have an arrangement in which both we and they can have our separate domains of independence. We in our own Israel, they perhaps by associating themselves with Jordan, and that therefore there would not be anybody, any condition in which either all the Israelis or all the Palestinians would be under the rule of a foreign power.
What, if any, responsibility do you think Israel has to Palestinians in the diaspora who were displaced by the creation of Israel?
I don't think we can do anything more except to make peace on the basis of the existing populations. After all, not all the Jews are going to be or are today under a sovereign Israeli flag. You can't say that the Arabs have got to have sovereignty wherever there are Arabs. And frankly, many of them, I see in your own country, in the United States, are not exactly the subjects of compassion or misery. They're not like the Bosnians. They have people in very high positions and high ranks. Even those who are outside the Palestine context would take pride in the knowledge that there did exist a nation with a Palestinian identity, just as Jews, even if they live in the United States or in Argentina or in Paris or anywhere, or in their own Russia, have a feeling that there is a Jewish state to which they could have recourse and shelter if necessary. But it doesn't mean to say that all the Jews of the world have any intention of putting themselves under the Israeli flag. And that must be the answer for the Arab states as well. On the other hand, if there was a peace, we could develop areas in the Middle East, develop water, for example, develop the port at Eilat together. Why should we have two ports within a few miles of each other? Develop the Dead Sea. Why should you have a sea divided between Israel and Jordan when they could develop it together?
You were in Israel when it was created as a nation. What do you think the importance of Israel is today to the identity and the security of Jews around the world?
Well, Israel is really the center of Jewish pride. It ensures the legacy. It consecrates the language. After, it is only in Israel that Jews face the world in their own identity, not just as a gloss on the life of other countries. Here we are, as we are, in our own identity, with our own faith, with our own tongue, with our own history. I think that therefore Jews stand very tall within their own frame of reference.
I want to quote something from the end of one of your previous books, your previous autobiography. You wrote in the end there, "I was disturbed by the excessive emphasis that diaspora Jewry places on the question of image. This obsessive concern arises out of a special Jewish experience. What other people have thought about Jews has often been an issue of life and death." Would you elaborate on that for us?
Well, there's a great sensitivity, especially amongst diaspora Jews, about not what Israel does or how Israel is, but what we look like. And really, that's, Israelis always think of what do people do for us. And Israelis and diaspora Jews consider what do people say about us. For example, there was an exchange of rhetoric between the United States and Israel. This didn't attach much. Israelis didn't attach much importance because, although the United States administration was arguing with us, they were also shoveling arms into us and abolishing the anti-Zionist resolution and pressing the Russians and the Ethiopians to open the gates. So we had a very positive picture of the American attitude to Israel. But Israelis just heard rumors that American leaders were talking about us in a not very complimentary way. I must say Israelis talk about other people also in a not very complimentary way. But these problems of how we look seem to affect Jews outside Israel more than they interest Jews inside Israel.
Why do you think that Jews outside Israel are more affected by image than Jews inside?
Because the Israeli spectacle, the Israeli reality affects them in terms of image. They don't pay taxes, they don't join our army. So what does Israel do for them? It increases their pride, it makes them feel good. And therefore, they very often ask this question, what does it look like? And they want us to succeed on television shows, on radio shows. I remember once going to some meeting in the Council of Foreign Relations, in which there were about 10% of the people were Jews. The Jews weren't listening to me at all. They were looking at the non-Jews to see if the non-Jews were reacting favorably to what I was saying. That's a difference of emphasis.
Do you ever find that damaging?
No, I think it's natural. Everybody is the product of his own particular reality.
Abba Iban, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Abba Iban has written a new memoir called Personal Witness, Israel Through My Eyes. He hosts a series called Israel, A Nation Is Born that will soon be broadcast on many public television stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's awfully hard to keep up with the international news and to make sense of the regional fighting that's broken out around the world. Coming up, we ask Fred Halliday to help put the wars of the post-Cold War era into some perspective. Halliday is a journalist and a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to various UN diplomats, U.S. military leaders will have to bow to some UN oversight of troops in Somalia. UN officials say a U.S. draft resolution before the UN Security Council could allow a U.S. general to command a proposed American force in Somalia and that daily operations would be in the hands of field commanders. The Bush administration has offered to send up to 30,000 troops to Somalia to get food to more than 1 million people faced with starvation. International relief efforts have been impeded by factional feuding and stealing. The State Department says 1,000 people in Somalia are dying every day from starvation. In Angola, government troops are poised to launch a major counteroffensive after former U.S.-backed rebels this week seized a northern capital. NPR's Suni Khalid reports that the State Department is in contact with both sides in an effort to prevent a resumption of open civil war 2 months after the nation's first multi-party elections.
The State Department continues to condemn the recent military moves by Angola's UNITA rebel movement. Earlier this week, UNITA forces seized the strategic northern provincial capital of Wij and a military airbase in heavy fighting. The attack came just days after UNITA agreed to a ceasefire with Angola's government. UNITA rebel leader Jonas Savimbi has told State Department officials that he has lost control of some of his commanders, and the attacks on Wij are the work of regional commanders he is unable to contact. But the Angolan government and the U.S. dismissed the claims, saying the military actions have been coordinated. Since losing the country's first democratic elections last September, UNITA has seized nearly 60% of Angola's territory. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
President Bush has resolved a bitter fight between two federal agencies over what Americans need to know about the food they eat. Officials of the Departments of Agriculture and Health and Human Services disagreed over new food labeling regulations. Laura Kanoy reports.
The new rules require standard nutrition information on all packaged food products. The labels will have to list fat, cholesterol, sodium, carbohydrates, and protein as a percentage of what's considered a healthy daily intake. The regulations also strictly define words like low fat and light. Health and Human Services Secretary Louis Sullivan had long criticized the confusing information on food labels. He called today's agreement a watershed.
The Tower of Babel in food labels has come down. And American consumers are the winners.
The food industry has until May 1994 to relabel all packaged products. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 8 points to close at 3,286.79 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. After liftoff from Cape Canaveral this morning, NASA officials announced this afternoon that astronauts on the Space Shuttle Discovery have deployed a military satellite. Launch was delayed for nearly 1.5 hours this morning until sunlight melted pieces of ice on the shuttle's fuel tank. After liftoff, there was a news blackout for 7.5 hours until the satellite was released. This was NASA's eighth and final shuttle launch of the year, the most since 1985. Only one shuttle flight had more than one launch attempt, and that was a one-day delay. A study published in the latest New England Journal of Medicine suggests that elderly women can reduce their risk of hip fractures by getting plenty of vitamin D3 along with calcium. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
Doctors have known for a long time that vitamin D helps people absorb calcium and that calcium is important to slow bone loss. But nobody knew whether vitamin D supplements would do much to reduce the risk of hip fractures, particularly in elderly women. To find out, scientists in France studied more than 3,000 women in nursing homes with an average age of 84 years. They discovered that women given extra calcium and vitamin D had 43% fewer hip fractures over the 18-month study period. Experts say that's a dramatic response, comparable to the effect of estrogen supplements. And the best part is, the skin manufactures vitamin D if it gets at least 15 minutes of bright sunlight a day. The National Institutes of Health plans to study this treatment in the huge Women's Health Initiative that's being planned right now. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
According to various U.S. officials, a number of steel-producing nations are planning to meet in Geneva next week in efforts to reach a world trade agreement. Yesterday, tariffs were imposed by the U.S. on foreign steel, but officials say the date of the meeting was chosen earlier this year. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's very difficult to make sense of today's international news. Fighting in the former Yugoslavia, armed bandits preventing food shipments in Somalia, neo-Nazi attacks in Germany, chaos in the former Soviet Union, uncertainty all over the Middle East. In each region where there is conflict, there's a different history and a different set of grievances behind the fighting. My guest is Fred Halliday, a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. We asked Halliday to help us make sense of the post-Cold War world.
The world is in chaos, and in that sense, talk about a new world order, whether by supporters of it or critics of it, is nonsense. We've got a new world disorder. But I don't think we should be too pessimistic, because in certain ways the world is still a better place than it was 5 years ago. First of all, the threat of nuclear war, which would have annihilated not just the present generations but the future of mankind, has very significantly receded, even if there is some greater amount of nuclear proliferation. It's not going to lead to a world conflagration. Secondly, the domination of the world by military conflict, i.e. war, or the threat of war in arms races or whatever, between great powers, which has dominated the war really since the last century, since the 1890s, when it began in Europe with Britain and Germany and France, and then in the Far East between Japan and Russia and China, that domination has ended. So we're now in a world where whatever else, and I think for a generation, a long generation, 30 years, the prospect of military conflict or serious preparation for military conflict between great powers has receded, and I repeat, for the first time for a century. Thirdly, there is a greater awareness in the world today, I think, of the interdependence of issues. In other words, that the world economy is one, and that even if you can have prosperity in some areas and not in others, you're not going to stop the populations from the poorer areas trying to move, whether it's from Mexico or from Russia into Western Europe. And also that the ecological issues which we face in many different dimensions are ones which are global. So these three things, I think, the retreat of the danger of worldwide nuclear war, the end of major military rivalry between great powers, and thirdly, some qualified but some greater awareness of interdependent issues, I think are positive. Now, having said that, clearly things are going very wrong. First of all, we live in a world where there is only one answer, capitalism, but capitalism hasn't solved the problem either of underdevelopment or the problem of world economic recession, and we're on the edge of major new problems in developed countries as well as in the third world. And secondly, you have this explosion of ethnic conflict and of very ferocious and short-sighted nationalism. Now, in one sense, nothing new about this. I mean, anybody who's studied the Arab-Israeli question or the Irish question will be eminently familiar at 5 minutes reading with what's happening in Yugoslavia or the Caucasus or Tajikistan or Punjab or whatever. All these nationalisms claim to be unique and individual. Actually, then they're all the same in many ways, including their refusal to compromise and their fake invocation of history. But that isn't something which ended, that isn't something which began with the end of the Cold War. It's something which we've seen developing in its current form over the last 20 years. After all, the Irish question exploded in the late 60s, the Basque question at the same time. Punjab has been smouldering for 15 years. But with the end of communist control in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union, and I would argue in Afghanistan, you are seeing these forces gaining ground in a very dangerous way. And tied to that is another process, which is the disintegration or weakening of states. Now, we all know states are oppressive. States are exploitative, they're parasitic, but if you don't have a state, you can be worse off, as is the case in Somalia, or as the case in Lebanon, or the case in Chad.
You know, I have this frustration, which I'm sure a lot of people feel. You pick up the newspaper and you're trying to make sense of what's happening around the world, and there are so many regional conflicts involved with historical disputes and ethnic identity, and so on, that it's really hard to comprehend the specifics of the fighting in the different regions. And I think a lot of people are almost giving up in frustration.
Well, I don't think people ever did understand them. They thought they did for two reasons, one or two reasons. One was they put them into a Cold War framework and said, well, let's look at the conflict in the Horn of Africa. The Eritreans, the communists, so the Ethiopians must be good, or vice versa. And the Arab-Israeli question, well, the Arabs get arms from Moscow, so the Israelis must be good. Or in 1948, 49, don't forget, the Israelis get support from Stalin, therefore the Arabs must be good, which a lot of people in the West thought. And so on and so on. In other words, they put these things into a Cold War framework, which never was apposite, but satisfied that intellectual curiosity that you mentioned. At least people thought they knew where to pigeonhole them, even if they actually didn't. Second thing is that most people, until recently, focused on one issue or the other. I mean, people from Ireland focused on the Irish question. People with Jewish background or people from the Arab side of the Middle East focused on the Arab-Israeli question. They didn't look at these things comparatively, whereas now you have to say there are all these things going on. And clearly, to bone up on the latest developments in Chechnya, Ingushetia, in the northern Caucasus, or what's happening in the Khojent region of Tajikistan, or in the Moro region of the Philippines, or the question of the expulsion of Muslims from Burma, requires a bit of work, and there's not much you can do about it. But I think beyond that, there is a reluctance to see that deep down these things have similar roots. They have socioeconomic roots, the lack of jobs, lack of states which can provide security and economic development to these people, and also a failure of political leadership, because throughout the post-communist world, but also in the post-colonial third world, people fall back on simplistic nationalist explanations. I mean, take the question of Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia. You listen to Croatians speaking fluent English who've lived in Britain for 20 years saying, what's wrong with Croatia is the Ottomans brought the Serb settlers who came here in the 16th century, or the 15th century. Now, wait a minute. This is a fake invocation of history to settle what are present disputes about land, about employment, to some extent about religion as well. And I think it's that repeated pattern of the misuse of the past. The past didn't cause these problems. It's the present which caused these problems. People don't go out and kill each other because something happened 100 years ago. They do it because of something now, like they think they could grab someone's land or someone's house, or in some case someone's women, or whatever it is. They'll go out and they'll kill for present reasons. And the past is the pretext, it's not the cause. And I think if you look at them comparatively, similar factors emerge. I'm not saying they're all the same, but I think very similar factors underlie all of these, with the deceptive fact that in each one everybody says that we're unique.
I'm wondering...
I think that the outside world has been much too indulgent of all this nonsense. We need what I would call an epoch of benign intolerance. That is, the outside states putting their foot down and saying, enough of all these. These things are not going to run their course. Look at Ireland. It hasn't run its course in 20 years.
My guest is Fred Halliday, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is professor and journalist Fred Halliday. He's written extensively about the Middle East and the Soviet Union. Is this period of international affairs making you any more pessimistic than you were before? Because now a lot of the fighting is no longer about ideology. It's about ethnicity or religion or other regional disputes. But, I mean, the fighting isn't stopping, even though some of the ideological battles like communism versus capitalism have ended.
Well, I am pessimistic, but I'm pessimistic for a reason which, even in my political generation, that's people who came to politics in the 1960s, has been clear for some time. And I would go to the two inter-ethnic conflicts that I know best, the Arab-Israeli question, which I've studied and talked to people from since the 1967 war, the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arab states, and the conflict at which I grew up, namely the conflict between Protestants and Catholics in Ireland. And without denying the differences between them, and there are many, and the dangers of false comparison are also many, I do think there is one underlying and pessimistic lesson, and that is a lesson which does depress me as I look around the world, and that is that people don't learn from their mistakes. People think in these, once they get into the dynamic of interethnic conflict, they think one last push and we'll make it, or the other people will come to their senses, or if we have another progressive atrocity, we'll be able to frighten the other side. And we have bombs going off in London virtually every night now, organised by the IRA, who believe that one more progressive atrocity in London and the British will change their mind. They're not going to. In other words, it's not just that people don't want to compromise, but there is a dynamic of conflict there which doesn't need majority support on either side. The paramilitary in Ireland, on the Protestant or the Catholic side in Northern Ireland, don't have the majority support of either community. They have indulgence of a significant minority. They're very small recruitment, but you can keep such a thing going. And that's on the basis of relatively slight historical injustices compared to what you have, say, in Yugoslavia or in the Caucasus or in Tajikistan or in Punjab, and I could go on. In other words, it's once that dynamic is up and running, it's very hard to stop. And there are always politicians around who will seek to abuse it, as there are on both sides of the communal divide in Ireland, and there are in the Irish-Israeli conflict and so on.
You said that you think in this period of ethnic intolerance and belligerence that there should be more, what was the expression you used?
Benign impatience.
Benign impatience, yeah, from other parts of the world, from other powers. What do you mean by that? And what's an example of how you think that could be done?
Well, I'll give you two examples. In the case of Yugoslavia, we've had now a war situation for close on a year. There's been a lot of hand-wringing, international conferences, ministerial visits to try and stop the Serbian war of aggression, first against Croatia and then against Bosnia. Perhaps 1.5 million people are now refugees in the rather cold winter of the Balkans, and tens of thousands of people have been killed. Had the international community acted quicker, been more impatient in the interests of stopping this process, in the interests of Croatia, Bosnia, and in my view, the interests of the Serbs, who have a place in the future of all this, the disaster would have been much less. Similarly, in the case of Somalia, the situation has been allowed to go for month after month after month after month, partly, frankly, because of the US elections, and nobody, Bush nor Clinton, wanted to risk anything by saying that anything should be done. So I think there's been too much saying, well, we must let these things run their course, or we must listen to both sides. People say, look, A, the international community is not willing to pay the price of these things going on for years, because the price will be even greater in terms of refugees, aid, arms flows, and so on. And secondly, there has been too much acceptance of the right of all these parties to do whatever they want. Now, you can call it intervention, you can call it imperialism, you can call it something in between. But frankly, that's better than just allowing all these things to run their course.
I wonder what you made of the focus on domestic affairs in the recent American elections.
Well, I visit the States a lot and have been doing so since the early 70s and have a lot of working relations with people in the States. I don't minimize for a minute the internal problems the United States has, but I do think there is a note of self-indulgence and exaggeration with regard to the whole issue of American decline. There are many problems the Americans haven't solved, and some of them, they're way behind other countries, such as controlling personal access to weapons or raising income tax and gasoline taxes to the normal levels of other developed countries. But having said all that, it still is a very rich country with immense political and economic potential, often abused, particularly in the last decade or two vis-a-vis the Third World. And the issue of American decline in overall terms is greatly overstated by Americans of the left and of the right. So it's quite proper that after the end of the Cold War and with all the internal issues in the United States, people should say, let's sort out our domestic questions. But there is a tinge of irresponsibility and a tinge, frankly, of self-indulgence in all this. I mean, you know, if you think that America is such an awful country, and you should try some of the problems of some of the other countries we have in the world, and developed countries, including this one. And that side of things, while preferable to jingoism and militarism of the kind that Bush might have espoused, A, is an inaccurate picture of where America stands in the world vis-a-vis other countries, and secondly, is one that leads to a turning away from what are, in my view, America's international responsibilities. Now, those responsibilities have been irresponsibly and violently used in the past, as in the war in Vietnam, as in the invasion of Panama. But in other respects, I think they have to be assumed, and the choice is not between America as it were, turning in on itself, or shouldn't be between America turning in itself or being an imperialist country, but between America playing a more or less positive international role.
My guest is professor and journalist Fred Halliday. We'll talk about the Middle East peace talks in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Somalia?
Well, we'll have a report from here first by Suni Khalid of our staff about plans for sending armed forces to Somalia, and also a talk with a relief worker in Mogadishu about what sorts of jobs those troops will have to do in order to facilitate the delivery of relief to people in the south of the country. Also, a talk today about the history of the treatment of tuberculosis. It's a disease that once again is threatening Americans. We'll talk with a physician who's written a history all about how fresh air cures and going out west were considered 100 years ago the best thing to do if you were consumptive.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Fred Halliday, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He's written extensively about the Soviet Union and the Middle East. America helped initiate the Middle East peace talks, which resume next week. They seem to be in a kind of stalemate. The last round ended early, not because so much had been accomplished, but because so little had been accomplished in that round. What are your hopes for them at the moment?
Well, I remain hopeful that these talks can yield something, but I admit, as anybody who knows much about this conflict must admit, that they could well end in failure. And there isn't infinite time. I wouldn't have thought there was more than a year or 18 months, partly because the Palestinians, delegates and those among the Palestinian community who support negotiation will have to be given something if they're not going to be overtaken and overwhelmed by a very strong hostility built up over many years within their own community to deals with Israel that must involve giving up most of what Palestinians have wanted to see. After all, the most the Palestinians are going to get out of this, the most, is a very circumscribed state in 10 years at the least, in 15 or 18% of what most Palestinians regard as their territory. Now, if they're not even going to get that, or the prospect of that, the Hanan Ashrawis and the Faisal Husseinis and even the Yasser Arafats of this world will be in the dustbin, or worse, and much more radical people will take over. On the Israeli side, the Labour Party people say, and they're probably right, that Likud was badly defeated in the last election, but with growing economic problems and stalemate in the talks, they may well gain ground. And so they've only got 18 months or a year as well. So I think something has to break in all this.
Do you see the Middle East peace talks as an example of what you were talking about earlier, everybody holding out for more than they could possibly get? And thinking just, well, one more stab at it and I know we'll get it. One more bomb attack or one more whatever and I know we'll get what we want.
Well, there are a lot of people on both sides who think that. There are a lot of Israelis who think, well, if we tough it out, the Palestinians will go away. They're only just refugees and so on and so forth. And there are very significant numbers of Palestinians, particularly young people, who think, what do we do negotiating with someone which has stolen 80% or all of our land, driven half of our people into refugee camps, bombed us, strafed us, tortured us and so forth? So there's a lot of bitterness there. It has to be said that, if anything, these talks go against my argument, because at least after 40 years, but I say at least, with enormous human suffering and waste of resources, we are now at a position where some compromise may be possible. For the most selfish of reasons, to do with oil and the U.S. economy, the U.S. government has got involved and tried to broker a solution and should be encouraged in that. And that is what the Palestinians want. If you read what Arafat made a big speech only a couple of days ago, he's saying, will the Americans get on and speak to the Israelis and put pressure on them? Nelson Mandela is saying the same thing from South Africa. So it's an example of people appealing to the U.S. to do something rather than to do nothing, whether or not they're imperialist.
Are you confident that the Arab countries are willing on any level to grant Israel's right to exist?
I've spent quite a lot of time in the Arab world since 1967, and I would say in the 70s and late 60s, very few people were willing to grant Israel's right to exist and were willing to talk about Israel as if it was another country. In fact, they very often find it very hard even to mention the name of the country. There's been a significant shift there. not an absolute one. There are people in the Arab world and elsewhere who don't want Israel to exist. But there are a significant number of people in government and among populations who are willing to accept a compromise peace, a just peace. First person who did that, to his credit, although few people gave him credit at the time, was Anwar Sadat in 1977, who went to Jerusalem. He squandered his opportunity, but he did break the ice. The Jordanians, I have no doubt, King Hussein or his successors, if he passes on, are committed to living with Israel. The PLO in late 1988, far too late in my view, 40 years too late indeed, nevertheless accepted a binational solution, and they're sticking to it. And any settlement will have to be made to stick by international guarantees on both sides, to restrain the Israelis and the Arabs. So there'll be a continuing international involvement. But I do think there is sufficient political will there, and this has been made all the stronger by the Gulf War, because in the Gulf itself, in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and elsewhere, they're no longer worried about being attacked by Israel, which was always their fantasy in the past. They're worried about being attacked either by Saddam or by the Iranians. And under right conditions, they're not only willing to have diplomatic relations with Israel, they're willing to do business with Israel. Some of them are already through indirect means. And that, I think, is another reason why the climate has changed. And if you just read the Arabic press, or look at Arabic television or radio, and even look at the willingness of Arab television stations now to interview Israeli officials who speak Arabic directly without a lot of nonsense and circumspection, this is an important breakthrough. So yes, there are people who don't want Israel to exist, but there has been a shift. And in terms of a feeling, a gut feeling, I would have said 10, 15 years ago, no. And now I would say yes, but it will involve guarantees.
You live in London. Which of the conflicts around the world now are hitting closest to home for you?
Well, if you live in London, the conflict that's hitting closest to home is the Irish question, because of the bombing campaign which the IRA is waging in the pre-Christmas period here, and which means that virtually every day parts of the city are closed off or underground stations are closed. Mercifully, few people have been killed so far, but I think that has not always been the case in the past and will not be again any more than it has been in Northern Ireland. Secondly, the Bosnian question, the issue of Bosnian refugees. After all, it's 2 hours' flight to Sarajevo from here. People go all the time, people go in buses, people are taking food and clothing, and people are bringing back refugees and trying to bring them into the country. And there's no easy solution to that question in terms of what policy should be or whether to try and look after them there or whatever. And of course, British troops are also involved. Then thirdly, there's the war in Somalia. After all, part of Somalia, the northern part, Somaliland, as it's now called, is a former British colony. There used to be, I would think, 500, maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000 Somalis living in this country. Now there are 20, 30, 40,000. They've been allowed in large numbers. Their conditions are terrible, as have people from other parts of Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa in general, and the Sudan. So that, because of the colonial link, that Horn of Africa issue is very, very present. Those three are particularly present here.
Well, Fred Halliday, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fred Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in London. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program was directed by Roberta Shirock and Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He's probably my favorite TV talk show host. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Gary Shandling. His current series, The Larry Sanders Show, satirizes late-night talk shows. Shandling used to be one of Carson's regular guest hosts. Also, we talk with John Digen, writer and director of the Australian film Flirting. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.